So you've been studying the book of Ruth, so I wanted to kind of play into that and give you my version of one particular aspect of the book of Ruth that I think God's teaching us, and that is, how do we deal with the poor? It's a topic, not the only topic, but it's the one you're also dealing with in this particular lesson, I believe, that you just got through. And I know you're going to do a little serve day today for Olive Crest, which is great. Have some friends who work there, and I know you've got a representative, a wonderful organization. But I think sometimes when we think about dealing with the poor, we're kind of confused on how to do it. I know I was, even when I worked at the church, wasn't really sure how to handle it. Living in an area where generally people are doing pretty well. And I've learned a lot at the URM, but I feel like even the churches I go to don't really know. They want to help, but they don't know what to do. Kind of like this fella, his friend had gave him a phone call. He said, hey, look, his friend had a refrigerated truck, and he was broken down. He said, hey, can you come out here? Because I got these penguins I'm supposed to take to the zoo. And I'm stuck on the side of the road. Would you come and pick these penguins up? Would you be willing to take them to the zoo for me? Because I don't know how long I'm going to be stuck here. He said, no problem. I'll come and do that for you. He says, I got the day off. So he drives over there. He brings his little truck. They put the little penguins in his truck, and off he goes. Later that day, the fellow with the refrigerated truck gets to the zoo, and he can't find the penguins. So he calls his buddy and says, hey, bro, I thought you were going to take the penguins to the zoo for me. I just talked to the administration. They haven't seen the penguins. He goes, no, I took the penguins to the zoo, and right now we're out getting ice cream. Kind of like the penguins, we don't know what to do with the poor. And sometimes what we try to do out of hearts that are pleasing to the Lord doesn't really accomplish what we want it to accomplish. As a matter of fact, sometimes it hurts. So what I want to do is I want to kind of give you a basic two-point outline for this idea from Ruth. Just kind of an overview. And then I want to tell you about what we do as it relates to what I've just talked about. So two thoughts. You ready for this one? Two thoughts about the book of Ruth as it relates to how do we deal with the poor. First thought is this. There is always a compelling story behind people experiencing poverty. There is always a compelling story behind people who are experiencing poverty. When you get to know the story, you get to understand the situation a little better. You'll have a better idea of how to deal with it once you know the backstory. Unfortunately, we have so many people come down to Skid Row, and you see it almost every day. People who I'm sure have pure hearts, they really want to help, and they show up, and they come out on the street. I remember one particular time they came out on the street, and they're giving out McDonald's cheeseburgers. And the reason I know this is because I heard some guys going, this was right after dinner. The guys are going outside, hey, man, they're giving away McDonald's cheeseburgers outside, and the whole street was littered with yellow paper, and all these people who just ate dinner had another burger. It's kind of like, we don't know what to do. And so, by the way, here's a tip. If it's intuitive, it's probably not needed because it's already being done. But when you get to know the story, you get to see a little bit more about what is really needed. Think about Ruth, right? Ruth and Naomi. Naomi, they lived in Bethlehem, and a famine hit. Could you imagine if you didn't have enough food to eat? Tragedy. So she's experiencing tragedy. Her husband, her two boys, what are they going to do? There's no food in the land. So what they do is they go to some place on the other side of the Dead Sea, a place called Moab, which is really a strange place for them to go because Moab is like our people who are despised by the Jews. They just didn't... They weren't just friendly, they despised them. They looked down on them, and vice versa. So here they are, now they're immigrants in a foreign country. Food is different. They have no home. They have no job. Doesn't really tell us how they survived, but apparently there was food there. So they go there. They've had this tragedy already. And then you wouldn't believe what happens next, right? You've already studied this. What happened? She experienced tremendous loss. Naomi lost her husband, the breadwinner. And guess what? The boys, they had married by this time. And then what happened? Both boys died. Naomi is in a foreign country. She is an outcast in that society. And now her husband's gone. And now both of her sons are dead. Wow. She's poor because of tremendous loss. You know, people are poor for a lot of different reasons, and you kind of have to find out the story to know what to do. Sometimes people are poor because they've made some bad choices. Sometimes they're poor because of sin, and they aren't blessed by God. Sometimes they're poor because tragedy strikes, and it had nothing to do with them. But anybody who's poor, mark it down, they're traumatized. And that is at the root of the problem. There's a compelling story behind every person experiencing poverty. You know, there's also various reasons people are rich. It's not just because God blesses them, although that could be one reason. They've got a lot of skills. They utilize them. They serve God. God blesses. But other people get rich by taking advantage of the poor, taking advantage of rules, violating God. But in a broken society, you can get rich that way if you're clever enough. So just because you're rich or just because you're poor doesn't mean you're good or you're bad. There's various reasons. But if you're going to help the poor, we have to first get the backstory. You know, when you talk about scripture stories, Jesus dealing with the woman who had the issue of blood. You remember that story? How do we know all the details about that woman, that she'd gone to all those doctors, that she's tried everything? She used to have resources. Now, because of her illness, she is completely poor. Why do we know all that? Because Jesus got the backstory. And it's been recorded for us. The guy who was laying at the pool, and we know that Jesus went by this guy, and he said, you know, he'd been waiting out there for years and years. And how do we know this? Because Jesus got the backstory. So when you're going to deal with the poor, the first thing we need to do is know why people are poor, what has happened to them, not what is wrong with them. What has happened? And most people we deal with on Skid Row, you know, you've got mental health problems, you have addictions now, because a lot of times addictions are really just ways to cope with your suffering. So it's better to numb yourself than to deal with your pain. And it's important to know those backstories. Otherwise, you know, we'll just think they're lazy. Well, you know, lazy is not something you can judge, because lazy is an outcome of something else. You have to know why someone is lazy. And a lot of times what you're seeing is not the root problem. A lot of people are lazy because they're in complete depression and they can't move. You ever feel so depressed you can't even get out of bed? Some people have this as an everyday occurrence. So getting the backstory, there's a compelling story behind every person experiencing poverty. You know, this is an old survey, but it was a big one, and that's why it kind of is telling. Back in the 1990s, right before the World Bank surveyed 60,000 people across these developing nations who were poor, and they wanted to do a study about how they viewed themselves. And they'd say, what is it? Tell us about being poor. Now, what was really fascinating about the study is the poor did not focus on their material needs, but rather their social and their psychological needs. The answers they got about what it's like to be poor talked in terms of shame, inferiority, powerlessness, humiliation, fear, hopelessness, social isolation, and voicelessness. Now, sometimes I'll be driving down Skid Row, and there'll be these people in the middle of the street just taking their sweet time. Some of them are walking right into the middle of the street. One day, there was a lady walking right down the middle of the street with absolutely no clothes on, and it was not Amanda Bynes. This is a regular occurrence. And even when they have their clothes on, sometimes they just like to take their sweet time. And they know you're there. And at first it used to irritate me, thinking, boy, you're really disrespecting the street and the laws and the drivers. And then it dawned on me what they were doing. They have absolutely no power in this world. They'll take whatever they can get. And if that means I can hold up traffic because I want to, then that's my way of showing power. And when you understand that, I wasn't irritated anymore. It's kind of like, okay, fair enough. When you're done with whatever you're doing in the road, I'll use it. But remember, there's a compelling story behind everyone who's experiencing poverty. And learning what that story is so critical to coming up with the right answers. And that leads us to the second point of the story of Ruth. That's this, that there is a biblical approach to dealing effectively with poverty. There is a biblical approach to dealing effectively with poverty. Now, there's a lot of different ideas about how to deal with poverty, and not every idea is equal. And depending probably on some of your political persuasions, you might have different ideas yourself. But, you know, the Democrats didn't write a Bible, nor did the Republicans. But Jesus did. And he cares about the poor. And he has an approach that is best utilized. And so I just want to give you some things you can see in the book of Ruth, where this is playing out. Now, you can see these principles throughout the Bible. You just have to look at them carefully, because every different section of your Bible, there's a different situation. For instance, in the Old Testament, when you read about the Jewish history, you got to remember there was no separation between church and state. So the way they handled it in the Old Testament, you might not handle it the same in the New Testament. But you can find principles in the book of Proverbs about dealing with the poor. You can see how they dealt with it in the Old Testament. And then every New Testament writer deals with it. And you can find principles in your New Testament, which is probably closer to what we would utilize today. But even then, things are different. But there's some basic principles we can apply. You ready? First one's this. Sensitivity. Boaz, by the way, Ruth and Naomi in the story, when you're thinking about it in terms of the poor, they represent humanity. Boaz is a type of Christ. Boaz is the guy who's going to redeem the poor, right? That's what Christ does for us. So what we're gonna see here, when we look at Boaz, we're gonna see how God would deal with the poor. Ready? Sensitivity. Some of us, if we aren't used to it, or we don't find ourselves around poverty, we're not real sensitive to it. As a matter of fact, I think about this often, you know, when I worked at a church, this one, and others, and deal with churches, it's interesting, the things we use to disciple people is more, I think in Western culture, we see discipleship is head knowledge, getting smarter about the Bible. Nothing wrong with that. That's important. But we see learning with a textbook and a pen and a paper. Jesus had a seminary of real life. And he just took the guys around and dealt with real life situations. And it's interesting when you think about maybe the most fundamental characteristic of Christ. If I said to you, what do you think is the most fundamental characteristic of Christ? What would you come up with? I think if you studied the Gospels, you might agree with me. I think it's compassion. I think he had compassion for people. It's love in action. The problem is if we only do discipleship in a classroom and we only study and develop our intellect, we neglect the heart. The heart is affected when you deal with people. And if you're going to really grow in compassion, you have to spend time with the poor. Now, that won't generally happen where we live. You have to be intentional. So, remember there's a backstory. And then think of this approach. So the first one is sensitivity. Beginning to have a sensitive heart. You got to get exposure for this to happen. Okay? This is empathy. This is understanding. It's really the first point I said, getting the backstories. When you understand where people have come from and the pain they've dealt with and the trauma they've had, it's going to affect your heart. It's going to pull you in. You're going to want to get involved. You're going to be feeling some sort of compassion for them instead of when we don't know the people, we tend to judge. And we tend to come up with pat answers that really are answering the wrong questions. You know, go get a job. Okay. That leads us to the second one, responsibility. But not just the responsibility of the poor. The poor have responsibility to get out of their poverty. And you see Ruth doing that, right? They just didn't sit there and wait for a handout. They went to work. They figured it out. They got in a position where God could do something. But there's a responsibility on the part of the church. Every church has a responsibility to the poor. The question is, what is your strategy? And who do you see as the poor? And we'll talk more about that in a second. But responsibility, every place in the Bible, it's going to talk about our responsibility to the poor. Even when Paul was going out, being sent out as a missionary, you know what they told him? We ask one thing of you, Paul, don't neglect the poor. It was that fundamental. Look in the book of Acts. Now, they didn't live in communes, as some people suggest, and get all kind of weird political ideas from that. That's not what happened. But they all had their own possessions, but when somebody was hurting in the church, they were willing to sell them to take care of that need. That's how responsible they felt. More on that in a minute. Third one is this, sensitivity, understanding it's a responsibility. By the way, do you realize you personally have a responsibility to the poor? You personally do too. Every single one of us, if we have more than we need, we have a level of responsibility to the poor. What are you doing as it relates to that? More on that. Third one is this, dignity. Handouts rob people of dignity. Things that we generally want to do to help the poor when we don't know the backstory can cause them to feel less than rather than helpful. So we don't want to rob people of their dignity when we're trying to help them. By the way, I moved into the mission when I first took the gig. I didn't know God was going to do this when I first talked to Mark and say, hey, I'm going to be leaving. Then God said, now I want you to move in because you don't know a thing of what you're doing. I go, I know, you called the wrong dude. He said, well, you're going to need to move in. So I did. And my reasoning was I didn't want them to think that I thought that I'm the rich white guy from Orange County going to fix their problems. And we tend to treat the poor that way. We're the hero, they're the project. That doesn't help anybody. So dignity. So when you deal with the poor, what is a dignified way to help the poor? Then opportunity. They need opportunities to see that God has gifted them, that they have abilities, that they have purpose, that they can use these things, they can make a difference. The kind of things that make you and I healthy, when we're healthy, are the things they lack. And so giving them opportunity, that's what the gleaning was all about, right? They'd leave on the fringes and on the corners so that the poor could come by and get the rest. And you see, Boaz went farther than that. He said, you know what, just don't even take all that stuff. Just leave it. And if she wants to go into the whole area, let her go. And if she wants to do it with the reapers and she wants to be a reaper, so be it. But the gleaning was something where, and we got to think about this strategy-wise in your own neighborhood here in San Clemente. How can you help the poor be active participants rather than passive recipients? We want to empower people to change their lives, not enable them to continue to live dysfunctionally. People would come to the mission and volunteer, and they go, hey, what do you think? Should we go buy some tents and give them to those people out there who don't have tents? And we'd say, no. They go, well, why? They're cold. They're going to get wet when it rains. I go, I know, but they wouldn't be wet if they were inside. And there are beds inside. It is a lack of dignity to leave people on the street who can't make good choices for themselves because they have a mental health problem or an addiction. To advocate to leave them on the street is not dignified. It's not compassionate. At least that's my personal opinion. So think of ways you can pull them in, ways you can get involved, mentoring, sponsoring families, people. I'll talk more about that in a minute. But I got to keep moving. Safety. Notice Boaz said, look, I've already informed the young men to stay away from her. Stick around with the ladies. So he was creating a safe environment. People who are experiencing poverty already feel less than. And by the way, if they don't look you in the eye, it's not because they're being disrespectful. It's because they're ashamed. And they think you probably think they're less than too. See, they're going to judge you just like sometimes we judge them. So you got to create a safe environment for them. Is the church safe? Is the gathering safe? And what I mean by that, I'm not talking about security. I'm talking about emotional safety. Will I be accepted? And then Boaz provided generosity. Caring is always associated with sharing. It's not caring if you don't share, if you don't give practical things to them in this process. It's interesting, James chapter 5 warns the rich, be careful, because what can happen when you're rich, and by the way, some of you are going, well, okay, he's not talking to me right now. Yeah, everybody in this room is rich compared to the world, right? Unless you, and you know what? And if you are not eating all your meals, please tell the leaders, they'll want to help you. We'll figure it out. But my assumption is that probably isn't the case. He says, be careful of living a life of luxury and self-indulgence while you're pinching pennies on the poor. That was my translation. While you ignore the poor. And we live in our nice houses, we drive nice cars, we go out to eat. And by the way, there's one. You go out to eat, guess what? The person serving you is probably not quite as well off as you. You can be generous with that tip. Blow them away. Are they poor? I don't know, they're poorer than we are probably. And even if they weren't, so what? I want to be generous, right? Be the best tipper. Don't negotiate the guy doing your lawn down. Negotiate him up. Ooh, there's a thought. Now, you're not charging me enough. I this is hard work. And, you know, I'm going to give you a bonus. You see, when you're generous to the poor, it puts Jesus in a good light. Because that's how he treats us. So just treat them the way, you know, Jesus treats you. It's kind of the New Testament principle, isn't it? All right, two more, and I got to talk about House to Home, and then I'm off. This one's really important, and you learn it in the book of Ruth. It's a principle called proximity. Proximity. The kinsman redeemer is the closest relative to the person who's in need. You go to them first. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you got this far yet in Boaz's story, but when Ruth comes to Boaz, he's not actually the closest relative. And so he goes and finds the closest relative. Uh-oh, spoiler alert. He finds the closest relative and says, hey, Ruth over here is our relative. You're the first in line. If you don't do it, I will. It's your responsibility first and your privilege first to help her. And he declined because he had his own inheritance issues and he didn't want to lose it. So he said, no, you got it, bro. And so Boaz does it. But it's teaching a principle. The first line of defense for the poor is the closest in proximity, not just spatially, but relationally. I remember something Mark taught me early on, years ago, because I would deal with people who'd come and say, I need. And one of the things Mark taught me, and he said, you know, look what it says in Timothy. Before the church gets involved, family gets involved. So, you know, people would come in, I'd say, okay, well, we want to make sure you're okay. Give me the phone number of your closest relatives. Let's call them right now. What? Yeah. It's family's privilege and responsibility to take care of their own. And if you don't, you're worse than an infidel, Paul said. By the way, do you have any family members who are poor? Are you taking care of them? Are you helping them in ways that are helpful? That's your responsibility. It's my responsibility. As a matter of fact, Jesus taught us that if you have to take money that you normally give to the church to give to your poor relative, do it. Because you're the first in line. And so it starts with family, and then it becomes local, right? It now becomes the church. What does the church do? What's the church strategy? And then what about the neighborhood? What about where the deeper needs are? What do we do? Each church has to figure this out based on your own environment, your own neighborhoods. We got a Spanish church right next door on Sundays. This could be an incredible way to partner, and we're already sponsoring them. I say we like I'm still here, but we already sponsor them. But what about the individuals? I mean, they're right here in the body of Christ. Maybe there'd be something we could do with that. What about our neighborhoods? What about other believers? What about a black church in LA? What if we partnered with a black church in LA with some women's group up there and said, how can we learn from each other and help one another in some poor community? I don't know. I'm just throwing out ideas for you. But proximity. You know how we do, how we take care of the poor in the United States? We give it to the federal government. That is the opposite approach to the biblical approach. Did you see that? Proximity. You know the farthest away you can get on this problem is let's give it to this big, giant organization and make it bigger. And let's have a one-size-fits-all solution and see how that goes. I get why we do it. And again, different political views. I get it. People are greedy, and rich people aren't always generous. And so the government jumps in. I get it, okay? I'm not saying that's wrong, but it's not the solution. We're not going to give credit to the White House for solving poverty. It should go to Christ. It's the Christians. What are we doing? Before the government took this project on, it used to be done by churches. They started the universities. They started the hospitals. They started the educational plans. They took care of the poor. And I'm not sure if the government solution has helped or hurt, because it keeps getting worse. There's more and more people on that roll. And you know what? It's a disincentive for the church to do anything. Because you might go, well, I pay my taxes. That takes care of it. But that's not the way it was designed. We're supposed to be personally involved. And so you see this idea of proximity. And by the way, just some ideas to help you understand something about the urban communities. People who are on welfare system, it's easy to get stuck. You know, if you take that too long, or if you keep giving someone money over and over, or goods over and over with nothing expected in response, what we're going to create is an entitlement and dependency. And that's not healthy. And that doesn't solve the problem. It becomes a disincentive to work and a disincentive to help. And in a real practical way, one of the problems we have in the urban community is single parent families. Because if the dad's working, they're going to get less. And so guess what happens? The dads don't make enough, so they move out. And you have single parent families. And we're actually destroying the home. Okay, enough of that. Last thing is this: sustainability. Got to have a sustainable plan. And you see, there's a long-term solution that Boaz has here. So just some biblical principles, how to effectively deal with the poor. The poor aren't going away, by the way. You know that, right? Jesus said, you're always going to have the poor. There is no solution to homelessness long-term, but we can end homelessness one family at a time. And that's what I want to talk about real quickly, Deed and Truth. We try to help end homelessness one family at a time. And our vision is this. If I had my logo on here, it would be a bridge. And there's two sides to a bridge. What we try to do, we feel like God's led us, is we connect, like a bridge connects, we connect people who are ready to change with people who are ready to make a difference. Realize not every person who is poor is ready to change. You can't really help them very much. A lot of the homeless you're going to meet in San Clemente are really on vacation at the beach. Really. There's not a lot you can do. Just don't add to the problem. But we work with those who've already gone through a program. So we're working with people who are ready to change. I was telling somebody just the other day, if I had to do the mentoring program, some of you are familiar with this, some of your husbands did it. If I did it all over again with what I know now, I'd mentor the graduates. Because when they're in the missions, they have chaplains, they have volunteers, they have support system. But when they leave and get that first apartment, it's exciting. But then they wake up the next day and go, oh my gosh, the apartment isn't the solution to my problems. What do I do? And generally, they go into an empty apartment. It's depressing. So one of the things Deed and Truth does is we are working with those, and we vet people who have gone through a mission program. They have to be referred to us. They had to leave in good standing. They had to be a graduate. That's usually a 1, 2, or 3-year program. And they have a job, and they have money in the bank, because if they don't, they're going to sell everything we give them if they get in trouble. So we're looking for a sustainable plan. They submit a sustainable plan. We ask them, how much do you make? What are your bills? Where are you spending money? And we evaluate all that, and we say, okay, they have a sustainable plan. This can work. We will help you move into your first house. And we have a storage unit, and Tony provides us a truck, and we get people like people at Pacific Coast Church and other churches who will help move them in. And so those are people who want to make a difference. So we're working with people who've already done the hard work. There's been a lot of transformation that has already taken place, but they're in this very pivotal place. The things that made them healthy are stripped away when they leave the mission, because it is that community that made them healthy. It is love that healed them. But now they're all on their own. Many of them had to just take a house wherever they can get it, and they're not even close to their church. And so we need people to come alongside of them. So we're asking people, let's not just make an event to move them in. Let's adopt them. Let's sponsor them and pay attention to them, that especially that first year, which is so critical, because so many people fall back into homelessness. And after all that time and energy and money spent, we don't want to see that happen. And we want to see the chain broke with those kids. So that's my story. That's what we do. What can you do? Well, on the table, there's a sign-up sheet, and you can put your name and email if you want to do one of two things. One is we'd love for you to subscribe to the blog. We send out a story, a blog, what's going on every couple weeks, and that'll go directly to your email if you give it to us. Make sure it's legible, and that would be the first place, because that will give you exposure to start working on your heart. Okay? Then you want to get involved, put a check on, I want to join the PCC team. PCC has a team. And at this point, I want to ask Kim to come up. Where's Kim? Kim, come on up. Kim is the lead at PCC, and she helps coordinate when it's time for PCC to move somebody in. And I just want Kim just to share why she's doing it. And so just kind of how house to home has impacted your life that you would be willing to say, I'll spend more time at this and help organize it. Go ahead, Kim.
Okay, I've never used one of these, but I guess it's working. I would say for me, like he said, homelessness is frustrating. I don't like it, but I don't know what to do about it. I've been a nurse for 41 years, so it's kind of innate in me that I want to help people. I also love to decorate. I helped move all my kids into their houses and went to the Goodwill and wherever we needed to go to find things to put it all together, and really enjoyed that. So when I heard about this ministry, I was like, it's almost kind of too good to be true, because it would just be fun for me. So, they've already done the hard work in finding these people. So I did get involved, I think, about a little over a year ago, and have helped with a number of the move-ins. And Lynette Merritt has been on some with me, and Kelsey, wherever she is. And Lynn Muslin, who's here, she has kind of like a house-to-home in her garage. So we get to go shopping, and I mean, we really bring everything. All the beds, the furniture, the dishes, pots and pans. I mean, it really, they move in and they have everything. And for me, it's just really fun to do. I enjoy the people that we do it with, the people that are gracious enough to let us come in their home and do this for them. They're just super neat people. And I think, like he was saying, once you get close to the homeless situation, they're people. They could be they're somebody's daughter, somebody's mom. A lot of them have kids. And they're just so excited when they come back from lunch and we've transformed their home. And it really, it's not just like we kind of put some stuff in their house. It looks like a model home. And I learned from, as my parents got older and had to downsize and they had so much stuff, and we're like, what do we do with all this stuff? You know, and my mom was like, that's so good. You can't just throw it away. And I said, we're not going to throw it away. We're going to donate it, put it out there to the universe. Somebody might need it. And now with something like Deed and Truth, they have places that have people give donations, and they just give the stuff to Deed and Truth, furniture and things. So it's almost like recycling, you know? So there's a lot of things that make you that feel good about it. And like you said, it's one person at a time. But and I think a big piece that he mentioned is that we need to pay attention to these people after they move in, too. So writing letters or phone calls. And
you're support. Right on schedule. You see there's things you can do pre-move in. We have to do shopping sometimes. We buy new stuff as it relates to bedding and towels and some kitchen items. And then there's the move-in day event where you can invite your husbands or your teenage kids or whoever else. And a post-move-in relational follow-up. That's what we're really working on now, developing where the churches really pay attention to this family, especially that first year, just making sure that when the kids have a birthday, they're loved on. And Christmas, maybe it's a great way to adopt a family at Christmas time that you actually know and invest in. Invite them to church, text them, encourage them, send them things to pray about that you want prayer. Ask them how you can pray for them. So there's ways to develop that relationship after the fact. So Kim, basically what I heard Kim say is, I'm a person who wants to make a difference. I'm ready.
And it's really fun.
So I guess the real, thanks Kim. Uh-huh. Let's give Kim a round of applause. Are you ready? Are you ready to hear from Olive Crest? Thanks for inviting me.